supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, raspberries are delicious, super nutritious, and they're incredibly easy to grow, especially if you live in a region that has cold winters. But what about if you live down where winters are relatively mild and summers are intensely hot? Can you grow fruits that have what's called a chilling requirement, like red raspberries? We will reveal the surprising answer and remind everybody about the basics of raspberry growing wherever you live. The rewards are amazing. But first, lots of your amazing phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Jack, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, I'm Mike. How's your day going?
It's just ducky so far. Jack, how about you?
It's spectacular.
Where is Jack's day being spectacular?
Altoona, Pennsylvania.
Up in Altoona. Very good. What can we do for Jack in upstate PA?
Well, this is a follow-up to a call I had into you 3 years ago about figs. At the time, middle of the winter, I got some cuttings. I sprouted them, rooted them, and in the springtime, I put them in the ground.
Right.
Against the southern exposure. And they've done pretty well. I had 155 figs this year. Last year, I wrapped them up. I didn't bury them. They're
right.
Shrubs now, and they're about 5 feet tall, maybe. But I had some dieback, and you had mentioned maybe building an extension around them.
Right.
And I did read your post how to do something like that. I'm just not quite sure how to do
it. That's all right, Jack. We're thinking of changing the name of the show to You Bet Your Figs. last week, it was black walnuts. This week, it's figs. You know, how did you wrap them?
Well, I bundled them together with twine.
That's good.
And then I put chicken wire around it and filled it in with straw and leaves, and then overwrapped that a couple of times. Leaving the top open, then I put a bucket over the top.
Okay, so what did you overwrap it with?
Used shower curtain, and then I had a thin tarpaulin on the outside of that.
You know, a tarp isn't the worst thing you could use. A shower curtain is too plasticky for me. First of all, it's great to tie the fig up to make it more workable. But then, honestly, the best thing to wrap around it would be burlap or one of the row cover materials. You can buy row covers at any good high-quality garden center, and they come in light-duty ones for the spring to cover your salad greens. Up in Altoona, you'd only want the heavy-duty ones. And this is like a spun polyester row cover blanket-like fabric. You would just wrap it around the trees and then wrap that with twine again. And that would do a great job of protecting the figs while still allowing them to breathe, if you know what I mean. The problem with stuff like plastic or a tarp is the plants can't really breathe. You're going to build up moisture inside. It's not the ideal situation. So if you wanted to continue wrapping, an old sheet, you know, that kind of a cottony fabric, if you don't want to go out and buy the heavy-duty row covers. The other thing that you would do, even if you built a frame around it, which would just be knocking together like some framing materials, and then some people would actually nail plywood over the frame, and then at the top do something that will allow the fig to breathe or have a piece of plywood angled sideways because you're going to get snow and you don't want it to lay on top of there. But again, if you're going to tie the fig up and you build a wooden frame around it, still the best thing to do would be to wrap burlap around that frame or wrap old sheets or, again, a heavy-duty row cover around that frame, because the ultimate is to block the wind. You know, you're never going to keep the fig warm.
Right.
You know, you're blocking the wind and you're preventing a lot of major league temperature fluctuations. You're not on a roller coaster inside that. But just blocking the wind and the dehydration of the winter wind is hugely beneficial. And then as soon as any plants in your region start greening up, you want to remove that cover. You don't need to leave it on for a long time. And you're always going to get a little bit of winter kill. So as soon as that fig starts to green up, and it should be one of the first plants to show new growth in your area, you want to cut back the winter dieback. If for any reason you don't have any winter dieback, I would still recommend giving the plant a very light haircut, just taking off like 3 inches of every branch. That'll stimulate the new growth that'll produce the figs without taking any of the biomass off. That'll give you your biggest crop.
Oh, that's terrific, Mike. And then just as an aside, I bought some strawberry plugs, Junebearers, and I put them in last week, so I'm going to see how that works out, too.
Because of your climate and because these plants are new and they're probably going through a little bit of transplant shock, that would be a great bed candidate for a row cover. And again, it wouldn't keep the plants warm, but it would protect them from, you know, the worst of the winter winds.
Yeah, I've read a lot of Elliot Coleman stuff, and we're in the same latitude as central Spain. So our problem is cold and not light.
Exactly. So,
yeah. Okay. Well, thank you, Mike. That's wonderful. I hope you have a pleasant day.
I hope you have a pleasant winter, Jack.
I will. Good talking with you.
Take care, man.
Okay, bye.
1-888-346-9499. Janet, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Yes, hello there, Mike McGrath. How are you?
I am just ducky today, Janet. How are you doing?
Fairly well, thank you.
And where is Janet well?
In the northeast corner of Bowie County, Texas, very near Texarkana, Texas, and Texarkana, Arkansas.
All right. What can we do for Janet in the Lone Star State?
Oh, Mike McGrath, please tell us about the monarch butterflies and how they like milkweed plants and will not harm ever intentionally any farmers or gardeners' vegetable crops or other flower crops.
Right.
Could you please?
Absolutely. It's always a pleasure. The monarchs, because of their amazing migration and they're such a beautiful butterfly, they fascinate people. And many of our listeners and many scientists think they're the canary in the coal mine. As the monarch population drops and rises, we're always trying to figure out if they're trying to tell us something about the environment. And I don't have any like hardcore information in front of me, but I get a lot of monarch information every year. And my sense is that after a couple of years of declines, we had an amazing monarch year this year.
Yes.
So
yes.
Two things, actually three things you can do to keep that migration going and to make sure there's lots of monarchs around for us to enjoy. The first, of course, is not to use pesticides in any form. And more we're learning that that includes don't grow or support the growing of genetically engineered corn or soybeans. These plants, they're really dicey. The herbicides that you farmers can then use when they use these genetically engineered crops are genetically engineered to take massive amounts of Roundup. The Roundup damages other plants in the environment, including plants that both the monarch babies would feed on, what are called host plants, and then very important plants at the end of the season, the nectar and pollen producing plants that the monarchs fatten up on before their migration. So, you know, don't use herbicides, don't use pesticides, don't spray anywhere where a bee or a butterfly might feed on the flowers. But then, if you want to up the ante, find the type of milkweed that will do well in your situation. Now, you're down in Texas, so what you want to do is you want to talk to your local extension service and see which kind of milkweeds flourish in your in your climate, and you want to plant those. And then, if you're really alert, you may find the caterpillars feeding on the milkweed. And
tell us about what they look like so that the general public listening to the You Bet Your Garden show will know and recognize the difference between a monarch butterfly's caterpillar that's not going to harm their crops or flowers or anything, and so they don't kill the butterflies' cocoons or, you know, the caterpillars.
Right.
Kind of a black and yellow and white stripe?
They're very distinctively colored, and many researchers feel that the coloring is to warn predators that they become slightly toxic as they feed on the milkweed plant. They are the only caterpillar you're going to find on milkweed. The only caterpillar that turns into a butterfly that damages any kind of food crops or wanted crops is also distinctively colored, and that turns into the beautiful swallowtail butterfly. So when that shows up on people's parsley and dill, a lot of people will just plant more of those plants the next year because the caterpillars and the butterflies are so remarkably colored. Now, the best resource for all of this is called Monarch Watch. And go online. You can sign up to report monarchs and send pictures of the ones in your yard. And anybody can sign up to be a part of the Monarch Watch program and get trained to tag butterflies.
I think I'm a member of that, and I also study the YouTube videos.
Mm-hmm.
National Geographic has documentaries, and et cetera, is very, very interesting.
Right. The takeaway is to plant a native milkweed or a milkweed that does well in your region for the caterpillars, but then don't forget to have some real good high-energy blooming food at the end of the season for the adults.
Oh, yeah.
And that's how to keep the populations high. All right, Janet, you take good care of your monarchs, and thanks for passing the word along.
Oh, thank you so much, Mike. Have a great day. God bless.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and warn everybody who's anxiously eyeballing their holly and evergreens not to prune those plants for holiday decorations too early. You got to wait until nights have been consistently cold and no sudden warm-ups are predicted. But don't go running outside with super glue and duct tape just yet, because we'll be right back to help you revel in raspberries and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, raspberries are easy to grow. They are absolutely delicious, and they are one of the three most nutritious foods you can eat. One of the others is blueberries, and I forget the third. They are really good for you and really tasty. And you can grow them almost anywhere if you get enough chilling hours over winter. Well, what does that mean to our friends down in Florida? We will explain exactly what it means and tell all of yous how to grow great raspberries after lots more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Lee, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, this is Mike McGrath.
Yes, sir, it is. Is this Lee?
Hey. Yeah, well, it's Leland. I don't go by Leland, though. It's kind of, I never did like that name. I just go by Lee. Hey, I've got some questions to ask you. I've got hickory nut trees, and two of them that I planted back in about 1980.
Right.
And they was just seedlings at the time. I planted them. They've been growing all this time. They've got real small hickory nuts on them. Now, I've found a tree over on State Road 1 in Portland, Jay County.
Where are you?
I'm in Puckett, Indiana, which is 5 3/10 miles east of Marion, which the Palm Sunday tornado took out back in 65.
Oh, so
there's not much left of the town. It's just about 15 homes and a graveyard.
Right around the same time, there was a famous Ash Wednesday nor'easter that wiped out one of my favorite places in Virginia. So anyway, now you've got hickory trees that are, if my math is correct, approaching 40 years of age.
Right. And they're pretty good size at the base. And I love to eat hickory nuts. They're good in brownies or in cakes or anything, but they're hard to open up. But they're real small. The ones I used to get over on State Road 1 was about almost the size of a 50-cent piece, and this
yes.
is without the hole on it.
Right. And yours will get to the same size.
Should I put a special fertilizer on this?
No.
And what can I do to keep the larva out of the holes?
Oh, okay. Two different questions. One, no, you should not feed these trees. Have you been fertilizing them?
No.
Okay,
have.
Good. You don't want to fertilize them. I have a hickory tree across the street from my house that drops nuts every 3 or 4 years. And
right.
the size is, as you describe, of the mature tree, about the size of a half dollar. Actually, I think my nuts are a little bigger than that. But I estimate the tree to be about 100 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, hickories take a long time to produce full-size nuts. This is the classic tree that you plant for the next generation. But, you know,
right.
yours are already bearing nuts, which is really good for the time frame. And what you'll notice as the tree progresses is you'll get some years where you get few to no nuts. And then every 3 to 4 to 5 years, you'll get a really big crop. Now, you got weevils or larvae or worms inside the nut itself?
Well, they start out, they go through the hole, and then there's a little bitty speck on the outside hole of the nut itself.
Right.
And they'll go in there, and then they'll bore a hole to get back out, and they come out like a bee moth.
Right.
You know?
And are they ruining the fruit, or it's just cosmetic?
No, they ruin the fruit. They go in there and they'll eat what meat is inside the nut itself, and then they leave.
Okay.
They bore a hole big enough to get out of, and then they leave.
How tall are the trees?
Oh, probably 45 to 50 feet.
Well,
right now.
The best answer here is a product called Surround, S-U-R-R-O-U-N-D. It's not a chemical. It's actually a spray on clay. It covers the trees in kind of a white powder from the time after the flowers fall while the nuts are forming, and it prevents any kinds of insects from getting into the fruit. Obviously, with a regular pressurized sprayer, you'd be able to get up around 20 feet. But if you ran this stuff through a pressure washer, you'd get most of the tree. The other thing is this could be a number of pests. You say you've seen the adult come out and it looks like a moth?
Well, it doesn't look like a moth. It looks like a little white worm, you know, like a bee moth.
We haven't seen the adult.
No.
Okay.
All I've seen the worms that come out of the nut itself.
Well, okay, it could be one of two types of pests. It could be a true weevil. But it could also be a form of a caterpillar. A lot of moths make this kind of damage on fruit trees and can cross over to nut trees. And in that case, you would spray the tree with BT, Bacillus thuringiensis. You don't have to remember that. All you have to remember is BT, and it's the organic caterpillar killer. It's been around for untold decades. It only affects caterpillars who chew on areas that were sprayed. And it's found at any independent garden center. Every reliable garden center sells BT.
Yeah.
So ask your county extension agent what the pest is specifically. If they tell you it's a moth, then you can spray the tree with BT as soon as the nuts form, and then, like, again, every 3 weeks. And guaranteed you won't get any larvae inside. The nice thing about the clay sprays, it doesn't matter what the pest is. The physical coating will prevent them from coming in. And oddly enough, it'll probably help you get larger nuts earlier. It seems to have some general positive effect on the size and quality of the fruits.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right, man, but your nuts will get bigger every year.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that.
All right, Lee?
Okay, thanks a lot.
Good luck, sir.
All right. Okay, bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Jess, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, hi, Mike. How are you?
I am just ducky today, Jess. How are you?
Great.
And where is Jess great?
So I live in Glenside, Pennsylvania.
Just outside of Philadelphia. Very nice community.
Yeah.
All right. What can we do for Jess in Glenside?
Well, I have a problem with a redbud tree.
Okay.
So my husband and I are new transplants to the suburbs from the city, and we had no idea what to do with a big yard that we moved to.
Right.
And so we've been committing ourselves to native plants as sort of a guide for our landscaping.
Okay.
So we wanted a small tree in front of the house, and we went with a redbud. And after about 6 months, it started to wilt.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't make it through the winter, and actually the top of it fell off.
Whoa. Yeah. That's a dead tree.
And we replaced it with another redbud from the same nursery, this one a little bit bigger.
Right.
And now, so it's been two winters,
mm-hmm.
and this year is starting to wilt again, similar to the first one.
Okay, so the devil's in the details. Now, did you get these plants bald and burlapped, or were they in pots?
I don't remember about the first one, but I'm pretty sure the second one was bald and burlapped.
Okay, so when you planted it, did you take all of the wrappings off, all of the burlap, all of the wire cage, any plastic down there?
Yes, we would have.
Okay. And then when you planted it, did you plant it high in the ground as opposed to low?
Yes, the root flare is about 2 inches above the soil
okay.
level.
Okay, very good. Did you fill the hole back up with native soil, the soil you dug out, or did you fill it up with nice stuff?
A mix of native soil and probably some organic compost from the same nursery.
Okay. If we're going to plant another tree, the basic rules are remove all the wrappings, dig a wide hole, not a deep one, which it sounds like you did. Don't amend the soil in the planting hole at all. Fill it back up with the soil you removed to encourage the roots to grow outward and not stay in that nice little circle of soil. It doesn't sound like it, but I have to ask the next question. Is the lawn treated with any kind of herbicides or pesticides?
So I think this year all we did was the corn gluten.
Okay. And how are your other plants doing?
Hit or miss. It has seemed to depend on, A, the plant itself, and B, the nursery where we got it from. So we had a service berry from a different nursery, but we planted at a similar time, and it has really not thrived at all.
Huh.
But it's still alive,
mm-hmm.
just barely. and blueberries from the same nursery as the service berry that also didn't do so well. But they're planted in the backyard, pretty separate from where the redbud is. The redbud just has a lot of lawn around it,
mm-hmm.
and on the other side, there's some kind of crabapple tree, and then the on the far side, it's a coosa dogwood.
Well, the blueberries need highly acidic soil, and they need a lot of sun. Service berries and redbuds are very forgiving plants. It's the fact that your service berry and your redbud aren't doing well leads me to believe there is some problem in the soil. What I'm going to suggest is ask somebody to come out and just take a look at the landscape, maybe do a soil sample themselves, and just look at it to see if it's just pure clay or something like that. Your alternative would be to contact your local county extension service and get a soil test kit, send it off, and you wouldn't be looking at their recommendations for fertilizer or pH. You'd be looking at the quality of your soil, the density, the amount of clay, the organic matter. These problems, even though it seems secondary, all your problems might be solved by aerating your entire property next fall, at the end of the summer, going into fall, punching holes throughout the entire landscape and removing soil to improve the drainage. when everything else seems to be going well, the problem could be soil compaction, especially since this is a new house to you. You don't know how much heavy machinery was in the yard, if the yard was ever aerated.
That's such a great point. It's a very old house, and right before we moved in, the previous owner dug out a basement in the back. So that's a very good thought.
Get that soil test done. You'll get the results back real fast now because nobody else is getting their soil tested and the lab is open all year. And then you've kind of missed the window to aerate. Although if you just wanted to go for it, it would not be too late in the season to do an aeration now. Be better than in the spring, quite honestly.
Okay.
Otherwise, you would plan, you know, to do it at the end of August next year.
Okay, great.
All right, good luck, Jess.
All right, thanks so much, Mike.
All right, bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Richard, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Rich. How are you, sir?
I'm fine.
And where is Rich Fine?
Richard is fine in Doylestown, Pennsylvania.
All right, just outside of Philadelphia. What can we do for you, Richard?
Well, I've noticed this year, unlike prior years, there have been a tremendous number of pine cones that have fallen on our property. We have a few pine trees, and there's an occasional pine cone, but there have been hundreds of them that I've had to pick up, and I have a front lawn that's maybe a quarter of an acre, but it becomes almost covered with the pine cones. And I'm not the only one who has experienced this. Friends of ours who also have property have said that they've also noticed the same thing. So I was wondering if it's a disease condition or if it's something about the sort of weird weather we've had this summer that has caused this.
Well, you know, now a lot of things come into perspective because one thing I've been talking about on the show the last couple of weeks is the insane number of black walnuts that have dropped in my neighborhood.
Yeah, I heard you talk about that.
Literally, the roadway is stained black. They are all over the place. They're an incredible tripping hazard when I'm out sucking up leaves from my compost. And I've also heard from many parts of the country about excessive acorn drops. And that's really dangerous. You can't leave acorns out on your property, or you shouldn't at least, because they're food for mice and they're food for deers, both of which are vectors for the ticks that carry Lyme and Rocky Mountain spotted fever. So a record acorn drop especially means more ticks and more Lyme disease in areas where those acorns aren't cleaned up promptly. So it's not just a question of making your landscape look good or anything like that. You got to get those acorns up. You don't want to feed an explosion of the mouse population for dozens of reasons, but specifically because every single, quote, deer tick has to spend part of its life on the white-footed field mouse.
Right.
And their prime food at this time of year is acorns. Now, what all these things have in common is these are the trees reproducing themselves. Whether it's the black walnut dropping, you know, its actual seed inside that husk, the acorn dropping its seed, or your pine cones, which are filled with seeds. These are all plants that are going nuts to procreate, to reproduce themselves. And that could be for two different reasons. One is that there's some cycle going on that is little understood, but we're in a year of what's called an excessive nut drop across the board. And that's because nuts and pine cones kind of fall into the same horticultural category. These things tend to be in cycles where you'll have a couple of, quote, dry years. I know with hickories, which are also in my neighborhood, most years you don't get any nuts, and then all of a sudden they're all over the place. So it's maybe these trees have all lapsed into the same cycle where this is just a tremendous nut drop year. More likely than that, however, is it's a sign of one of two things. Either the trees are incredibly happy. They have so many energy reserves that they can produce amazing amounts of seed. Or they're really, really stressed. A lot of times when you get excessive nut drop, excessive acorns and pine cones, it means the trees are actually afraid of dying and they're trying to reproduce their DNA to save their species. The warm winters in general we've been experiencing, I looked at some climate data the other day that was frightening. The average temperature is going up dramatically. So maybe that makes some trees really happy. I know it makes some trees really stressed that need a cooling period, but it's probably a reaction to climate change. It's probably a reaction to the warmer winters, and only the next couple of years are going to tell us whether it was a stress reaction or
not.
The extra winter gave them extra growing time, more time to collect nutrients, more time to photosynthesize. Yeah. Certainly, the trees that aren't being attacked by invasive insects, like the ash tree, they seem to be very happy, as you know, because you live in the same area as me. We've had delightful fall color.
Yes, we have.
But in general, you can expect something big like this every 3 to 5 years with any kind of tree. And, you know, hopefully this means that next year there's not going to be a big mess on the lawns.
I got to get them off the lawn or it'll ruin my lawnmower.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. So get them off the lawn, but they're not the danger for next year that acorns are.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you. I mean, we're hearing reports of this from all over. It's very interesting. Only time will tell, man.
Okay. Take care.
All right. Thank you, Richard.
Like your show.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody in the land of deciduous to keep sucking and shredding as many of those fall leaves as possible. Because no gardener ever got to August and said, gee, I wish I had fewer shredded leaves for mulch and compost making right now. But don't go looking for the conversion kit that turns your blower into a sucker just yet, because we'll be right back to rave about raspberries and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will get to raspberries, my favorite fruit, one of the most nutritious foods you can eat, and one of the easiest things you can grow in your landscape. We'll tell you how to grow them, where it's hot, where it's cold, and where it's in between. After a couple more of your hot and cold running phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Gregory, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, sir. How are you?
I'm good. Yourself?
I am just ducky today. Thank you. Where is Gregory Good?
Well, I'm in East Tennessee, around the Gatlinburg, Tennessee area.
Okay.
The Smoky Mountains.
A beautiful area. What can we do for you, sir?
I've got some South Carolina peach seeds from earlier in the year, beautiful South Carolina peaches, and I was curious, can I plant them in my zone? And if so, when should I plant them?
Well, yes, you can. And okay. Unlike apples, peaches are true to seed. That is, if you get a fabulous peach and you save the seed and you plant it and you nurture the little tree for 7 or 8 years until it gets big enough to produce, that should be the same exact peaches. And there's no real difference in your region. I know it's warmer down in the Carolinas, but all peaches have a certain chilling requirement. Even though they're considered this southern crop, they have a chilling requirement like apples. For instance, you can't grow peaches in far southern Florida or Texas or out on the West Coast. They need a certain number of hours below 40 degrees every winter to go through their seasonality. So the problem is it's going to take so many years. If you were to go out and buy this variety as a tree at a good garden center or by mail order, yeah, it'd cost you a couple of bucks. But you'd get peaches in 2 years as opposed to 7 or 8, because your seed is going to have to produce biomass. Now, how cold do your winters get?
Well, we do get snow.
Right. That's what I'm thinking. I'm not worried about the chilling requirement. It's just, you know, a baby tree like that probably should be nurtured. So what you would do is you would get some good pots with drainage, and you would get a nice bag of, it could be called potting mix, seed starting mix, soil-free mix, but essentially no dirt. It would be a combination of peat, perlite, vermiculite, and some compost or composted forest products. The bag should be very light. And how many seeds do you have?
About a half a dozen.
Okay. So I would get 6 pots. And, you know, because one bag is going to fill all the pots. Make sure the pots are at least a quart, somewhere between a quart and a gallon. And fill them with the mix. And then what you want to do is put the pots in a sink with some couple inches of water in the bottom and put something heavy on top, like a plate, so they don't float away. And then just let the drainage holes at the bottom absorb the water, really saturate the mix. And then put a seed in the center of each pot and then cover that with like 2-3 inches more of mix and make sure you rewater it again. And then put them in a place. Right now, we don't need light. They just need to stay moderately warm, not really hot, just normal room temperature for now.
Okay.
And then it's going to take a while to sprout, but you'll get little trees. And then in the spring, you would take them outside. I don't know if you have deer or rabbits in your area, but the smartest thing to do would be take them outside in an area that gets good sun, and then just put a little wire cage around them so rabbits can't run up and nibble on them and deer can't reach down because they would devour the whole thing. And then water them like once a week deeply. Don't give them a little bit of water every day. You would just like slowly use a watering can, go from one to the other and until they're really saturated. Just do that once a week. And then the first winter after that, I would bury the pots up to the soil line in a nice protected area and do the same thing with the caging. Because in the winter, that's when rabbits and mice and voles and deer are going to be the most dangerous because a lot of their natural food is gone. Then the following spring, take the trees that look good and plant them in the ground where you hope the peach trees will go. They got to get morning sun. They would prefer full sun. They would prefer not to be in a full southern exposure because then the bark is going to get heated up over the winter. But give them as much sun as you can in an area with good drainage and plant them high. Don't bury the trunk. If it looks like a lollipop, replant the tree so it's higher. Don't improve the soil in the planting hole. When you dig the hole, refill it with the soil you took out, and then get some good quality compost and make a fresh mulch of compost around the tree every season. When the trees get to be 3-4 years old, they'll start to be looking good. And then a couple years after that, they should start to produce peaches. And what they need is good airflow. At that point, you'll need to be pruning them every spring to keep them nice and open. But you would have to do that with any established tree as well. The important part is protecting them when they're young. As you progress in this, I want you to go to our website. Go to youbetyourgarden.org. Click on Garden Answers A to Z at the top of the page. Go to P for peaches, and it'll tell you what to do once these things start to get 2 or 3 or 4 years old. All right?
I appreciate the knowledge.
All right. Well, good luck, Greg.
Thank you kindly.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Annie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks. I'm having a little problem with my forsythia bushes and my azaleas. I live south of Buffalo, New York, so it's pretty cold here in Ellicottville. And they've decided to bloom. I have bloomed between the leaves of my forsythia bushes, and I've got buds on my azaleas. So I'd love some advice on how to prune them or not prune them so that they bloom again next year.
I can remember things like this happening back when I first started gardening in the 70s. Every once in a while, you'd get those kind of warm spells with enough cold weather in between that the plants would get good chilling, and then it would warm up, kind of an overdone Indian summer. And that's what a lot of people are experiencing right now. I have blooms on my forsythia. Luckily, my azaleas and rhododendrons haven't done anything yet, but a lot of people have azaleas that are supposed to be repeat blooming, like the Encore line. So it would not be unusual for them to produce some flowers in the fall. That's what the plants were kind of bred to be able to do. So there are some buds that won't open till spring, but the ones that do open in the fall, they won't bloom again in the spring. But there should be enough on the plant you don't notice the difference. The forsythia is tough. I mean, if it bursts into full bloom, then let's all just go out and buy $100 bottles of wine and drink them on the street corner because it's the end of the world. But the forsythia is a couple of flowers here and there. It's nice to see. I don't think it's going to hurt the plant. You should have buds on your azaleas and rhododendrons, especially the rhododendrons. The flower buds are really prominent. They tend to be fully formed by the end of July. Same thing on the azaleas. They're just not as prominent sometimes. But this is happening to a lot of people's plants in a lot of places.
Well, I've never really been able to get my forsythia to bloom like in a huge abundance in the spring. I've tried pruning it at different times, and nothing seems to help. But now the first time it's really blooming, you can barely see the blooms because of all the green leaves.
If you have been pruning forsythia without really being sure what you were doing, you probably did remove quite a few flowers. The only time it's really safe to prune these spring bloomers, like azaleas, forsythia, and rhododendrons, and other spring-blooming plants, is right after they finish flowering.
That's how I've done it.
Yeah, exactly. And then, but, you know, forsythia is very rangy. A lot of people plant it thinking they can keep it in a nice compact shape or a hedge. And it's, exactly. It's more like Don King's hair. It's totally uncontrollable. It's a force of nature. So by the end of the summer, it's not unusual on mine to have 10, 12-foot long whips coming out the top.
Well, and that's what mine looks like, and I like it that way because it's a good snow block and wind block for my driveway.
It really is. It's a great and underused privacy plant because it's so hardy. But really, there shouldn't be any problem with forsythia blooming in the spring. They don't need any help. They don't need any phosphorus or anything. The only thing that would prevent them having a lot of bloom is to apply any kind of nitrogen heavy fertilizer in the area, or, you know, treat a lawn that would be adjacent to the forsythia. Even organic lawn foods are very high in nitrogen. So if you spread a lot of that and even properly feed a lawn, you could inhibit the flowering of nearby plants because nitrogen will grow the plant big, but it'll inhibit flowering.
You know, I've done absolutely nothing to it, but I wasn't sure if I should just leave it and hope for the best for the spring or whack it down.
Oh, yeah. No. You can whack it down after the spring But no, right. As you said, leave it up now. It's a great defense against snow and high wind. It's some height in the wintertime that's not a tree.
Do you think it will bloom in the spring?
Yes.
Or we'll just have to wait and see?
Oh, no, no. They'll always bloom somewhat. The big issue with plants that aren't designed to rebloom is every little part of them that blooms now will not bloom again in the spring.
Super.
All right, Ann?
Well, thanks. You've been a great help. I appreciate it so much.
All right. You take care. Thank you.
Yep. Love the show.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. How far south can you grow raspberries? Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please read us this week's torrid question.
I'd be happy to. Marion in Central Florida writes, can raspberries be grown here successfully? If so, when should they be planted? Do they like shade, full sun, or mixed? We're in the Ocala area, about 40 miles south of Gainesville. We have had nights drop into the mid-high 20s, usually warming into the 30s during the day. Cold snaps go in cycles of 2 to 4 days, and occasional frost is seen, mostly from January through mid-March. Blueberries do really well here. I'm interested in trying raspberries partially because Pillsbury used to make great raspberry strudel toaster pastries, but I've not seen them in stores for months. So I thought maybe I could grow the berries and make my own.
You know, listeners in colder parts of the country are probably shocked to hear about frost and freezing cold in Central Florida, but that's the surprising reality. When one of my favorite bosses retired from radio and decided to move to Florida, he made it a point to only look at places below the frost line so that he could grow exotic plants and tomatoes year-round without having to worry about protecting the plants.
So he can't grow raspberries because they require a certain number of chilling hours to bear fruit.
That's right. Now, quote, the book says that the most basic type, the red raspberry, can only be grown as far south as USDA Zone 6. But that's wrong. I personally know of many patches that thrive in Zone 7 and 8. Now, the trick down in Central Florida is going to be to plant in a spot that gets morning sun but afternoon shade.
I'm pretty sure you say that about every plant.
Yeah, you know, it does seem like that sometimes, doesn't it? Anyway, in the Northeast, Mid-Atlantic, Midwest, and other cold winter regions, raspberries should get full sun. So should popular summer plants like tomatoes and peppers. But when you get to areas where winter is mostly mild and summers are intensely hot, those same plants really need a break later in the day.
Right. You often say that for most plants, quote, full sun means full sun in the north, a little shade in USDA Zone 7, and serious afternoon shade in higher zones. It's easy to forget that catalog plant descriptions have to try and cover the entire country, while in reality, plants are going to have very different needs in, say, Minnesota than San Diego.
And in San Diego, raspberries are difficult to impossible to grow. But we have two strong clues that our listener might be able to do better. One is that she seems to get a good number of chilling hours, and the other is that she says blueberries do well in her region. Now, I presume that these are blueberries that are bred to do better down south, like rabbit eyes, but they still need a winter chill, and if they produce fruit, so should raspberry canes.
You already answered her question about sun exposure. What about planting time?
Same for everybody everywhere in the country, in the spring. You buy dormant canes, mail order from a nursery, and plant them in the ground around the same time as tomatoes. If you know somebody who's already growing raspberries nearby, see if you can bum a few plants from them in the spring when lots of new shoots pop up in established patches. Those canes should already be adapted to the local climate.
So there are two basic types of red raspberries, right?
Yeah. The most common type is known as fall-bearing, which is half-right, and ever-bearing, which is a complete lie.
You're talking about your kind of raspberries.
Yes, which fruit twice a year. But it's in a way that really confuses the heck out of people when they first hear the sequence. New canes sprout up from the soil in the spring. They grow all season long, and then they produce a nice crop of berries at the very tips of their canes in late fall. Then those canes go dormant. They may look dead, but don't dare prune them. because the following year they'll sprout new green growth all up and down the canes and produce a big flush of berries just as summer arrives.
You never bring raspberries in to share in the fall, but you bring in pints in late spring.
My harvest ratio is almost 10 to 1. That so-called second crop is enormous.
The other basic type of raspberry is truly ever-bearing, right?
Yeah, sometimes called summer bearers. They pretty much fruit all season long. You should consult your local county extension service when choosing varieties. They're the real expert on what varieties are going to do best in your area. Unfortunately, some extension services are still not the best when it comes to what we call cultural care, though.
Oh, because they recommend high-potency chemical salts as fertilizers.
Which is crazy. Raspberries do best in poor soil with little to no added nutrition. Maybe a couple shovelfuls of compost every once in a while. If you use chemical fertilizers on them, you'll get insects, disease, and inferior fruit. What raspberries really need is room to spread. They are not well-behaved plants, and the best patches are planted with lots of room to roam. They also need superior drainage, especially if you're going to grow them in really warm areas where they're going to need lots of extra water on really hot days. Well, that sure was some great information about growing raspberries where the sun always shines. Now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to take a blow dryer to my canes if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore, at garden@whyy.org, as long as you include your location. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find the answers to all those emails you were going to send us, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. We continue to send get well wishes to Elizabeth Perez Luna, executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter continues to play our theme song. We are assisting our parole officer, Sweet Staven Naomi Sterobin, in her inquiries. Our engineer, Al Banks, is taking the fifth. Our social media director, Amanda McGrath, avoids interrogation on our Facebook page. Our wonderful webmasters, Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz, use really big type. Typecast Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our editor, Al Banks, is type B. Our intern, Robert Fogarty, plays to type. Our head chairman, associate producer of Production Association is Brett Rader. I'm typecast Mike McGrath, lamenting that I ever agreed to wear the cape and fight for truth, justice, in the organic way back in the 50s. Oh well, no time for that now, Lois. It's one of our most frequently asked questions. You're moving to a new house, and you want to take some of your precious plants with you. Mike McGrath, and we'll slide down this surprisingly slippery slope and take your fabulous phone calls on the next You Bet Your Garden.